Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, the only moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casinos, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about China with two superb analysts from China Uncensored. We've got Chris and Shelley. Guys, thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely.
So what is it that, tell us about China Uncensored and what is it that got you guys into this?
So I think the big thing is, you know, now in 2023, most people understand that the Chinese Communist Party is a threat and having a real impact on the United States and around the world. Mm-hmm. But when we started the show in 2012, everyone, it was still kind of in the post 2008 Olympic days people had. They saw the opening ceremonies and were like, oh, wow, China's amazing. It's up and coming. It's so different than that Tiananmen Square massacre era that was only about 20 years before. And yeah, people just didn't know anything about China. They, like, I talked to people and they still thought China was a democracy because they have a quote unquote president. So we wanted to just get the word out that the Chinese Communist Party, communism, it is a real and present threat. The Cold War, the Second Cold War has been going on for a long time and just people weren't aware. And we thought if we used a little bit of humor, some sarcasm, maybe we could get a little more people to actually watch.
Well, it's fantastically successful. I know you've got you know, a huge viewership, so clearly you're resonating with people.
It seems that way. I love hearing comments from people. We have a great comment section. YouTube comment sections can be sometimes dumpster fires, but I think we have a really good community on the show.
Fantastic.
And Shelley,
Shelley, what's your background?
I was born in China, came to the US fairly young when I was about 4 years old. And my interest in China was primarily cultural until I was a teenager. And then I had some family friends who were arrested in China for practicing Falun Gong. So, and these were family friends who had been literally visiting my parents and I like a month before in America. And we took them to Washington DC in the White House and we're walking around the Capitol building. And then a month later, they were literally taken to a police station. So it was like a very dramatic thing. And they had a daughter who was my age, who was basically left orphaned at home. Because both her parents were suddenly arrested. So it was kind of, for me, like a political awakening in terms of like what the Chinese Communist Party actually was, because my parents had lived through the Cultural Revolution, they had lived through the famine, but they kind of tried to shield my sister and I from the reality of the political situation. My uncle had been protesting on Tiananmen Square as a student, but you know, like I knew about these things, but like I was so young that I couldn't really grasp what they actually meant for the lives of the people in China at the time. So, you know, after like my mother's best friend spent, you know, 5 years in prison and she came out like blind in her left eye from being electrocuted by cattle prods, like that was like a huge change in how I viewed the country where I was born. And I had been very proud to be a Chinese person and it was a huge shock to my system. So like, that's when I started doing a lot of like human rights work with like Amnesty International in college and things like that. And eventually that led me to doing journalism, initially like financial journalism related to China, and then kind of met Chris through my sister. Actually, they were going to college together. And like eventually when Chris came up with the idea of China Uncensored, like I was like, this is what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to have a show that's like The Daily Show, but for China. But I didn't think anybody could pull it off. And then Chris did.
Yeah, I mean, it's been enormously successful. And actually, I wasn't going to ask about historic topics, but since you brought it up, let's touch on Tiananmen Square, because I remember the way it was portrayed here in the West. It was portrayed as if it was an uprising for democracy, as if Chinese people were looking to vote for their local town council or whatever it is. I've heard a lot of takes since that actually it was an economically led issue, that inflation had been high and unemployment was getting out of hand. And it was primarily that sort of pushback against that. What's your perspective, having had family members who were actually there? What was Tiananmen Square actually all about?
I mean, I think initially what happened was that the Communist Party had decided in the 80s to do economic reforms because essentially their economy was dying. So there was a lot more economic freedom suddenly. And I think that was definitely the catalyst for a lot of students deciding that, you know, with economic freedom, maybe this is also the time to ask for more political freedom. And it wasn't initially that people were asking for, you know, a democratic system, because they didn't really understand what that meant. Like, they grew up under a communist system, but they were asking for the communist system to give them more political rights and freedoms, the way that they were slowly expanding to more economic rights and freedoms. But in the end, the Communist Party, like, the essentially wasn't interested in that. And I think it was clear now that we know in retrospect that they were always going to politically crack down on the students. But at the time, I think the students had a lot of hope that, you know, the party could reform. I mean, a few years ago, we interviewed a man who was a student protester in Tiananmen Square, and he had his legs crushed by a tank when the tanks rolled in. And so he lost his legs. And it took him many years to get out of China. But he told us that at the time, like, he felt like they were a bit naive about the Communist Party, that they felt like, you know, their parents lived under the Cultural Revolution, but they didn't tell them what had happened during the Cultural Revolution. So, like, they were naive and felt like the party could reform, that they could ask for reforms from the party. And so he said that now one of the things he does is, like, talk to young Chinese people about Tiananmen Square, which many people don't know actually happened. I have, you know, multiple friends who had to learn about it after leaving China. Like,
oh, so it's common for Chinese young people not to know anything about Tiananmen Square?
Either not to know anything or to be told that, like, it was, you know, when the students attacked the soldiers, and the students were very violent and they were the ones who caused, like, all this bloodshed. But I think as the years go by, the more common narrative is that, you know, nobody knows anything about it at all.
Okay, that's interesting. And you touched on, of course, it started from those grants of economic freedoms, and the Chinese have had that period of economic expansion. But I guess my first question has to be to you, how sustainable is that economic expansion? And I'm thinking there particularly in terms of we've seen a large credit boom in China, we've seen a large housing boom, and a lot of these things feel very unsustainable. So how sustainable is this economic model that they've been running, that they've based their success on?
Well, I think first I just want to provide a little bit of context to the idea that the Chinese Communist Party gave economic freedom. Like, under Mao, basically, China did not have an economy. People were forced into communes, collectivized farms. It was a disaster. There was mass famine, cannibalism. So, when Mao died, there was, you know, obviously a realization that that didn't really work very well. But the economic freedom was still very minuscule. Chinese people still were never allowed to unionize. Obviously, they had no freedom of speech to protest for better wages or better rights. Still, the economy was controlled mainly by state-owned corporations, or even after things became more privatized, they were still companies run by the sons and daughters of top communist officials. You still basically have to be a Communist Party member to reach an upper echelon of Chinese society. So the Chinese Communist Party still has tremendous control over all levels of society, including the economy. So when we say there was more economic freedom in China, there's an asterisk next to that. Freedom in under communism.
The challenge is put to me often that we often talk on this channel about how the West is facing a severe credit boom and the issues that they're running up against that, this constant credit expansion. But that's also been happening in China. And China have also got the added complication of the credit boom that we've experienced, coupled with the boom that we had back in 2008, which is that housing boom. You've got these large, cultural push to invest in property rather than perhaps what the Western model, which is more towards stock investing and perhaps crypto and a number of other things. So I'm just wondering, how close do you feel that this is to a real fission point?
So we just actually talked to an expert who specializes in the Chinese economy. His name's Christopher Balding. He made a very good point. He says that the Chinese economy has reached its event horizon. And the event horizon, that's the point where when you get too close to a black hole, you can't escape. You're going to be sucked in to the black hole. And you sort of see this kind of the brilliance of how the Chinese Communist Party leveraged the state control over its economy for propaganda purposes. So 2008, there was a crash. Certainly it made the Western economic systems and the Western powers seem pretty weak and bad. Essentially what China did with the communist state control of the country was just build everything around debt, funding massive infrastructure projects. So it kind of created an artificial boom. And this had a really profound propaganda effect because, number one, for Chinese people, who, as Shelley was mentioning, people who grew up under the Cultural Revolution, time where China had absolutely nothing, suddenly they see all these skyscrapers going up. Their little podunk town now has a big airport. So to them, it seems like, hey, China's really massively building up. And to Western observers, it's like, hey, a lot of the infrastructure in the West is crumbling and in decay. China's building all this new stuff. This is fantastic. They must really have something to their system.
It's a sort of constant meme that you see on Twitter of the Shanghai by night, and it looks absolutely fabulous.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's very powerful propaganda. And keep in mind, most of China does not look like that. China today is still a very, very poor country. I think it's like 600 million people still make less than $10 a day. It's still a very poor country. But there is this show that really attracted a lot of Western investors and people like Michael Bloomberg, who see, hey, China can build bridges. The problem is, like some village in the middle of nowhere doesn't need a massive airport. That's not based on the market. And so as this debt bubble kept growing and growing, the Chinese Communist Party managed to keep kicking things down the line. There was a big stock market crash a few years ago. They kind of saved that by pumping everything into real estate. The real estate is exploding now. And you've basically come to the inevitable conclusion of their economic model, one of just constant pumping in debt. And now they're reaching a point where it's just not sustainable.
Yeah, I would say that it isn't so much that like culturally Chinese people want to invest everything in property. It is that historically there haven't been anything that they could invest in. Like until the 90s, you could not even own property in China privately. Like if you had an apartment, that was given to you by your workplace, which is like a state-owned workplace. You work in a work unit, you are assigned an apartment, kind of like, Soviet Union style. So the idea that people could buy property when essentially as part of like these economic reforms, the government tried to like essentially make it possible for local governments to make money by selling property, like by selling land to private companies, the developers who can then build these apartment buildings, skyscrapers on this, what used to be farmland or whatever. That was like a way for local governments to make money, because like in China, the way that taxes work is like taxes go to the central government. Local governments cannot levy their own taxes. So primarily the way that they make money for the last 30 years is to sell land to developers. And then at first this worked because there was a lot of land And, you know, there was like a huge market because people weren't able to buy housing before. So now you had people being like, okay, I'm going to buy. When you start to have this like more income and you start to save and you start to be like, okay, I can buy, you know, not only like one apartment, but I can buy two apartments, three apartments. Like, this is actually how I'm going to save my money. It is by investing in property, because the real estate market just keeps going up, you know, and the government will guarantee that it goes up, partly because local governments need that money. They need the developers to keep buying land. So they need that property to keep going up. Plus, everybody has investments in there, including like communist officials. Like, they put a lot of the money that they get through bribery and corruption into these real estate markets as well. So, you know, everybody had this vested interest in the property market keep going, increasing. And then every time you think that the bubble's going to pop, the government will save the private developers from bankruptcy.
Yeah, I forget what it was. It was maybe 18 months, maybe 2 years ago, that one of the big real estate banks was on the verge of going under, rescued by the Chinese. And a lot of people were saying that was going to be the moment. So what was that, Chris?
Probably Evergrande.
Yes, Evergrande. You're thinking. Yeah, so you know, we feel that they're sort of in the same sort of situation as a lot of these Western countries. They are just basically trapped in a debt spiral at this point.
And they kind of are a one-trick pony, like, in terms of, like I said, like, the local governments are, you know, basically dependent on these land sales. So in the same way that the way that the Chinese economy grows is through GDP growth, right? So through infrastructure development, because every time you build something, that adds to GDP. So if you've got a target of, you know, this year we have to reach like 5.5% GDP, 6% GDP, like, how you're going to do it is by building bridges, even if you don't need them, building apartment buildings, even if no one's going to live with them, in them. And so, like, they're financing all of this now through like increasing amounts of debt, but like, they can't really stop doing that, because that would essentially, you know, grind the whole economy to a halt. And all of the numbers that they need to show, like, these communist, local communist officials need to show their superiors that they're, you know, they're doing something, right? So they don't get fired, like, that they're all incentivized to keep building on more and more debt.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been you know, sort of reticent to use GDP as my sort of primary measure for the economy, because, I mean, well, in China's case in particular, you are dependent on the government to tell you what that number is in the first place. But secondly, it's just a measure of spending. It doesn't tell you whether that spending is particularly useful. You can literally build a bridge to nowhere, and or, you know, or empty skyscrapers, and it still counts towards GDP. What about the living standards of Chinese people? Are Chinese people continuing to see that improvement in living standards and the prospects for their children?
I think that is the big thing that is changing China right now. After the Tiananmen Square massacre, there really was this kind of Faustian bargain the party made with the people, that if you don't protest, if you accept no political or social reform or freedom, you'll have a chance to get rich. Or maybe your children will. But so, particularly as it regards to the real estate, what happened with Evergrande was that with this whole debt model, people would buy apartments that didn't exist. Evergrande would then take that money and build those apartments. But over time, they started to run out of money. Those apartments wouldn't be built, but people had already bought apartments that don't exist and were still paying mortgages on a house that didn't exist. So from that one aspect, again, as Shelley was mentioning, real estate is the primary investment sector for what you would call the Chinese middle class. So that's failing. And even if you do own a home in China, the market is such that it's very difficult to sell homes anymore. So basically, any liquidity you have is stuck in that home. You can't actually get that money out of the house. The zero COVID policy and the complete destruction of the Chinese economy that caused, that was also a case of, oh, maybe our children aren't going to have a better life for us than we did as kids. You see the massive youth unemployment. And again, what they did with education was very similar to what they did with infrastructure and all aspects of the economy, that, you know, there's this promise, like, go to university, get these degrees. There'll be something better for you if you do that. And now Chinese youth are finding that there are actually no jobs. And the amount of the Chinese education system is incredibly competitive. In fact, culturally, that's considered one of the only places in Chinese society where people can compete on even footing. It's how well you do on your high school exit exam, the Gaokao. If you do well, you can compete with even the daughter of a communist official. But what does it mean if you go to university and can't find a job, you can't find a home? For men, there's, because of the sex selective abortion from the one child policy, where people were only allowed one child, there are now 30 million more men than there are women. So you have a huge population of young men who can't find a wife, who can't find a job. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because, of course, we're talking about GDP growth, but I mean, essentially what GDP is, I mean, it's you know, GDP per capita times capita, and you know, the capita, the number of people, that's in serious decline because of this one child policy. How are the Chinese authorities responding to this challenge, that declining population?
I've gone on record as saying that I believe that within the next 10 years or so, we will start to see the government starting to go in the opposite direction of the one-child policy and trying to coerce people to have children. I mean, we're already seeing, in the last 10 years, they went from the one-child policy to a two-child policy. And now it's a three-child policy. And essentially, like, now it's kind of like, have as many children as you want, but nobody wants to have more than one kid because of the economic situation in China. It's very expensive to raise kids, and you've had this generation of, like, only children who don't have any problem with being only children, and they're looking at it increasingly expensive, like, cost of living, and they're like, well, why would I have more than one kid? It's, I'm, like, pouring all my resources into this one kid. I don't have the money to have more kids. So
the government don't really, even want one kid.
Yeah,
like, and I mean, yeah, people can't find a job. You don't want.
Would a three-child policy be as coercive as the one-child policy was? Because, I mean, the one-child policy was quite strict. I mean, are they going to start arresting people who don't have three children? I mean, how would that actually work?
Well, right now it's kind of just like, we are going to encourage you to have more kids.
Okay.
You know, when my mom gave birth to me in China, it was in the 80s, so the one-child policy was, like, at its, you know, like, because it was implemented in, like, 1980. So, like, that was, like, the first decade of it, and like, the enforcement was very, like, it could be very different depending on, like, where you lived. If you were in a more urban area, like, you had, you got pregnant, the family planning was one of the ways that governments made money, because they could fine people for having more than one kid, and the fine would be equivalent to, like, a year of salary or more, depending on like, what level of society you're in. And if you could not pay that, then that's when, like, the forced abortions and things came in. Although for more rural areas where, like, people would not be able to pay that kind of money, like, the forced abortions were a lot. I mean, like, it was very barbaric. Like, because the way that China exists under the communist system, like, a lot of things are, like, targets, right? Like, you have your GDP target, but you might also have a target, like, you're not allowed to have more than, you know, 100 births in a year in this county or something like that. And so officials, there are now stories coming to light of, like, I mean, these are extreme cases. It's not the way it was around the whole country, but there are, you know, things coming to light about how, like, local officials literally were killing babies, like, that had already been born. So they wouldn't have to report that they had, like, you know, violated the target number of children born, you know, like, it's just, like,
these. It's very important. Like, yeah. They love the Shanghai skyline imagery.
Yeah.
All of this is what's behind that.
Yeah. I mean, like, it is horrifying. And, like, what the one child policy created is kind of this almost like permanent underclass in China, because there's also the hukou system, which is like a household registration system. So if you have, like, a rural hukou, like, you cannot go and live and work in urban areas legally. So what started to happen is that, like, you know, but, like, all the factory jobs are in urban areas. So people would kind of, you know, have to leave their children behind to go work in these urban areas. Like if you had an undocumented second child, they would not have a hukou. So they don't have a household registration. So they become essentially like an illegal immigrant in their own country.
Where,
like,
extraordinary.
They can't go to school. They can't get like official medical care if they don't have like this household registration. So like you have this like kind of hidden population of people. And so like that 30 million number of more men than women, that might not be accurate because we actually don't know how many people had girls and then like they just weren't reported. Like they tried to hide them from the government so that they could live essentially.
Is China not inclined to approach this the same way that Western countries do, which is to simply import people? Because of course you've got a huge amount of people in Southeast Asia and India that you could bring on to do a lot of these factory jobs. Do they not want to approach it through immigration?
They're not a very immigration friendly country right now. They may have to change that as their, you know, workforce population gets older, fewer people are able to work in factories, you know, fewer people want those factory jobs because they're, you know, now blue collar jobs. They're now seen as less, you know, enticing as they were like 15 years ago when like that was a real stepping stone to making more money. But like now people are like, oh, they want more, you know, white collar jobs. But like, it could happen, but it's not currently, like government hasn't currently done that yet. Like they're just trying to enforce this more, like have more babies essentially. You know, they're giving right now incentives like, oh, you know, maybe like childcare incentives, like money, like to help offset some of the costs, but that's still not working right now. They're trying to get people to get married, have kids younger, which goes against like the education message that they've been pushing for decades, which is like get higher education degrees. And like, about a decade or 15 years ago, they actually started this campaign called about like leftover women, where the China All Women's, the China Women's Federation, which is the official like feminist organization of the Chinese Communist Party, started this campaign to call women who are over the age of 26, highly educated women over the age of 26 who weren't married yet, they called them leftover women. And they started this whole propaganda campaign about how you don't want to be a leftover woman, you know, like nobody's going to want you. And the purpose of that was to shame these women into getting married and having kids younger, not just to increase the quantity of the population, but to increase the quality of the population. And like they would use words like, you know, increasing the quality of the population, which, I mean, to us in the West, maybe sounds a little like eugenics, but like, but like the trying to make is that,
right? Yeah, you know, like, yeah, when did the one child policy end?
It ended about a decade ago.
I forget the exact year. COVID time.
Okay. So I'm just thinking if it started in the early 80s, so I mean you're going to get a reduced supply of people in their 40s, and if it ended about a decade ago. I mean, so it's really over the course of the sort of the next 20 years, you're going to get that really strong impact on the working age population. I mean, it seems like this is a problem that is really going to hit home for China in the 2030s and 2040s in quite a serious way, unless they change something significant, which is to go to, because if you try and, you know, shame women into having more children now, you've got another 20 year lag, and that's not going to do you anything until later in the 2040s.
Like the idea of having foreigners come in and work, I don't think the Chinese Communist Party would like that. One, because you have a whole population of people coming into the country who have not been from birth ideologically educated the way the party wants. That adds an element of instability. Also, typically what happens when people move to a country to work, especially factory type jobs, they want to make money to send back to their families in their home country. The Chinese Communist Party has very tight controls over how much money people can get out of China because they don't want money leaving China. I think they put a limit of it's $50,000 a year that you can take out of China. There are all kinds of ways top communist officials get around that, so they can be, you know, buy apartments in New York. Yeah. But so if I, that would be a big barrier to anyone coming to the country, that they couldn't send it money back to their families.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.